The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to this special episode of Riddle Me That. I'm Jules, and I'm joined by my Path Went Chilly co-host and the host of The Trail Went Cold, Robin Warder. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me for this one.
You're so welcome. I'm also joined by my friend Julie Murray, who most of you will know as Maura Murray's sister, who's a tireless advocate for Maura. So we did a couple episodes during my coverage of Maura Murray's disappearance. We also did a collaboration on the unsolved murder of real estate agent Lindsay Buziak. So I'm excited to have you back, Julie.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jules. And it's nice to meet you, Robin. I'm glad that I can join you and give a family member perspective on such a similar case as Maura's.
So do you want to talk a little bit about Maura and your journey fighting for truth and justice, Julie?
Yes. So Jules, first, thank you for always giving me the platform to talk about Maura a bit. For those who don't know, briefly, my little sister Maura disappeared in 2004 from a small town in New Hampshire. She disappeared the week that Facebook launched, actually, and is deemed the first missing person case of the digital age. My family and I have been searching for her ever since. She essentially vanished into thin air in a matter of minutes, and we have never seen or heard from her since. I live every day haunted by the unknown, desperately seeking out answers.
So, Robin, on this case, why don't you give us a brief synopsis?
March 18th, 2000, Whatcom County, Washington. A damaged Jeep belonging to 23-year-old Leah Roberts is found at the bottom of an embankment after it presumably crashed off a remote highway. 9 days earlier, Leah had left her home in North Carolina to take a cross-country road trip, but even though all of her personal possessions are left behind at the accident scene, Leah herself is missing. The investigation uncovers evidence to suggest that the accident was staged and that Leah may have been harmed by an unknown third party, but no trace of her is ever found. After that, the trail went cold and the path went chilly.
So Robin and I had discussed the similarities between Leah's case and the case of Maura Murray. Julie, what was your first impression when you looked into this case?
Well, I think Leah's case is the absolute most similar case that I've come across to Maura's. You know, both generally occurring during the same time frame, early 2000s, before the social media boom. Both women went on trips without telling anyone, both involved in abandoned cars in relatively remote areas, neither showing any immediate signs of struggle or injury, and the lack of cell or bank activity. They are eerily similar in so many ways.
So I originally covered Leah Roberts' case on The Trail Went Cold earlier this year. It's been featured on a number of podcasts and TV shows. I first became familiar with it when it was on Unsolved Mysteries in the early 2000s. And it was also on the TV show Disappeared, which is also covered Maura's case. And I remember when I started The Trail Went Cold, this was one of my most highly requested cases, maybe one of my most top 10 most requested cases. So that's why I finally decided to do an episode. But Leah Roberts was a young woman who seemed to be struggling to find herself before she abruptly decided to leave her home in North Carolina to take a cross-country road trip without telling anyone beforehand. It seems like she was planning to visit a location from one of the novels written by her favorite author, Jack Kerouac, and sure enough, her abandoned Jeep would soon be discovered near that location around 3,000 miles away in Washington State. On the surface, it seemed like Leah had gotten into a serious accident after crashing down an embankment into a wooded area, but an extensive search of the area turned up no trace of her, and oddly, there didn't seem to be any evidence to suggest that she had suffered any injuries from the crash.
So the investigation would turn up some odd clues, including an anonymous phone call about a sighting of Leah, and she was looking disoriented. This was at a gas station. And an eyewitness who claimed he'd seen Leah with an unidentified man at a shopping mall restaurant shortly before she disappeared. So it seems like police are now leaning towards the theory that Leah was not even inside the Jeep when it crashed into the embankment, and the entire accident scene was staged. But if so, what actually happened to Leah? Well, that's definitely a big mystery, so we're going to have a lot to discuss in this episode. Are you ready to dive in, Julie?
Yes, I'm ready. And I have to say, my heart goes out to Leah's family, I know her two siblings live each day in the unknowing, much like I do. I know their pain all too well. If nothing else, I hope that sharing my similar experiences, that they feel they're not alone.
Our story begins in 2000, and our central figure is 23-year-old Leah Roberts, who currently lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and shares a rented house with her roommate, Nicole Bennett. Leah was originally born in Durham and was the youngest of three children, as she had a brother named Heath and a sister named Cara. Unfortunately, the siblings have dealt with unimaginable tragedy over the past few years, having lost their mother to heart disease and their father to a chronic lung illness. The tragedy was further compounded for Leah during the fall of 1998, when she was involved in a serious car accident after crashing into a truck, which left her with a punctured lung and a shattered femur, which required a metal rod to be inserted into her leg. Even though Leah made a full recovery, the combination of the accident and the loss of both of her parents seemed to change her outlook on life.
That's an incredible amount of trauma for a person of any age to deal with, especially in such a short amount of time. Given that she was only 23, adds a whole nother layer of nuance to the situation. Mara was also very young, 21, when she disappeared, juggling her own unique set of life stressors.
I can't even imagine what this would be like, losing both of your parents. You never assume you're going to lose your parents in your 20s.
Yeah, so we lost my mother after Mara disappeared, and it was really crazy because my mom passed away on Mara's birthday.
That's so heartbreaking. Your mom was dealing with cancer, correct?
Right, yeah, my mom died of cancer.
And a broken heart and the grief that goes along with having a missing child and having no resolution, I'm sure didn't help the illness and didn't help your mom during that period of time when she could have been using the time to heal. But I think a broken heart, you hear that so often with cases of missing kids or with murders that are unsolved. And I've heard family members say things like they died of a broken heart.
That was kind of the same thing when we covered Keith Warren's case, although a while back, his mother died, I think, at the age of between 50 and 60 at a relatively young age. And her surviving daughter said the same thing about her, that the devastation and the stress from her son's death probably caused her to die of a broken heart at a young age.
Yeah, that was exactly what I thought of, too. It was one of those situations where it was just another mystery, because I remember Sherry Warren saying, we never found out what happened to my mom, why she died. They couldn't find a cause of death. So not only are they dealing with Keith's death and how it's likely an unsolved murder and not a completed suicide, but you've got a family that's going, well, our loved one has died and we don't have a cause of death. So we're going to say a broken heart because it's the thing that makes the most sense. So the fact that Leah was dealing with all of this trauma, and Mora was also dealing with a bunch of things around the time that she disappeared. What were some of those things, Julie?
Yeah, so lots of things swirling around in Mara's life at the time. And, you know, when you're 21, your outlook on life and the things that are relatively small, like fights with a boyfriend or getting a bad grade in school, those are magnified because your life experience is so small. But yes, she had transferred schools. She had to get a whole new group of friends. She was having issues with her boyfriend. So there was a lot going on.
So at the start of the new millennium, Leah was in her senior year at North Carolina State University, where she'd planned to get a degree in Spanish and anthropology. But even though she was only a few months away from graduation, Leah made the sudden decision to drop out. At this point, Leah doesn't have a job and is living off an inheritance her parents left for her. She spends several hours a day hanging out and writing in her journal at a local coffee house, where the staff has nicknamed her Double Cap Girl, since she shows up and orders a double cappuccino every single morning. Leah's also very interested in poetry and spirituality, and has taken up such other hobbies as guitar and photography. I love these dreamy aspects about Leah.
Yeah, these are very important aspects to discuss to give Leah some level of humanity. I've struggled a lot with my sister's case, where online sleuths remove that aspect and treat her more like a character in a book. Leah was dimensional, as are we all. And I love these type of details to help reinforce the fact that we're talking about a real person.
Yeah, from what I've seen about this case, I remember seeing it featured on Disappeared. There was no one in Leah's life who had a bad thing to say about her. It just seemed like everyone she crossed paths with just really liked her and thought she was really special, which is why they were all just so devastated when she went missing without explanation.
I love that we have these details about Leah and like could flesh her out as a human being. And the same thing with Maura, like, because we have so many people that cared about Maura, I feel like you get a really good idea of who she was.
So on March the 9th, Leah's roommate, Nicole, returned home from work and noticed that Leah and her white 1993 Jeep Cherokee were not there. And a pet kitten that Leah had adopted named Bee was also gone. Earlier that morning, Leah had spoken with her sister, Cara, on the phone, but never shared any plans with her about going anywhere. Leah and Nicole had spoken about doing some babysitting together the following day, but Leah missed their scheduled appointment, and by this point, she had still not returned home. Over the next 4 days, Nicole received a number of phone calls from people who claimed that Leah had made plans with them, but never showed up or attempted to contact them. Leah never contacted her family either, which concerned Cara enough to pay a visit to her house on March the 13th. When she checked Leah's bedroom, Cara noticed that a large number of her clothes and personal possessions were missing, which seemed to suggest that Leah had left on a trip, even though she never told anyone about her plans. For this reason, Cara still felt compelled to contact the police and officially report Leah missing.
Yeah, this part struck a chord with me, as Maura did almost the exact same thing. I spoke to Maura the Saturday before she disappeared on that Monday, and she didn't utter a word about an upcoming trip. Part of me thinks perhaps her trip wasn't planned at all, and it was more of a spur-of-the-moment type of trip. Leah didn't mention her trip either, but it seemed that she did make some hasty preparations prior to leaving. Similarly, Maura emailed her professors, turned in her homework, and called looking for lodging the day that she left.
This is the confusing part. It's like within maybe 24 or 12 hours, it looks like Maura had planned her trip, and maybe Leah planned hers even further in advance, but was being secretive about it. And maybe it was because people were going to have reservations about her going on this trip. I mean, I can imagine those close to her already had reservations about Leah dropping out of school. Like, she only had a few months left. It wasn't like she was halfway done her degree. You know, most people would be like, Leah, just, you know, buckle down and finish your degree. You're so, so close. So to go on this impromptu road trip, maybe she just didn't want to tell anybody, but it seems so almost out of character. She's so connected to so many people. She seems to have these friendships, these people who speak so highly of her. And the same thing goes for Maura. Like, you two were so close, Julie. So for her to not mention this trip, it really does make you wonder if it was just a spur of the moment trip.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my situation, I think maybe Maura didn't tell me because she knew I would have said, what are you, crazy? No, you're not going to do that. So it's more, hey, I'm going to do this trip. I know it's probably not safe, probably not smart, but I'll just ask for forgiveness. And maybe Leah did the same thing.
Well, because Maura's car was not in like 100% shape, right? Like, it wasn't the best. So if she was to tell you, hey, Julie, I'm going to drive in the snow in terrible weather conditions in this car to go on this trip for hours, I'm sure you would have been sensible, because I definitely know you're very sensible. And you probably would have said, like, your car's not going to make it. Like, what are you thinking, Maura? And so I can understand why she wouldn't tell you when you put it in that context. But I don't understand why Leah wouldn't tell anybody. I mean, they already know the most incendiary detail, which is like, hey, I'm not going back to school. I'm not finishing my degree right now. I would think that it would be sort of within the realm of what you think Leah would be doing, is to go on this road trip to find herself. And I don't know, I haven't heard much of her siblings speak about her. Have you, Robin?
Not really. I mean, they just said that she was kind of a private person around this time period, that it felt like she didn't know what she wanted to do with her life. And that's why she dropped out of school and was pretty much living off her parents' inheritance. I don't think she had any idea what she wanted to do for a living and what her future plans were. And I do wonder how long she had planned this trip, or if it was just a spur of the moment thing she decided that day. Because in Maura's case, she did tend to some of her affairs because she emailed her professors. But Leah spoke to no one before she did this. I mean, she had a babysitting appointment the next day, plans with other people. But she didn't even call any of these people to say, I have to cancel, or even make up an excuse for canceling. She just took off without speaking to anybody. So that's the big mystery here, is when did she decide she was going to do this?
So Cara decided to perform another search of Leah's room. And this time she finally noticed a note that Leah had left behind on her dresser. It was accompanied by some cash that Leah left for Nicole in order to cover her share of rent and expenses for the month. The note contained a drawing of the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland and some cryptic writing in which Leah implied she'd gone away on a lengthy road trip, but she would eventually return. The line which really stuck out was, quote, "I'm not suicidal, I'm the opposite. Remember Jack Kerouac," end quote. And this really stuck with me.
Yeah, the note Leah left is very curious to me. I kind of feel torn about the fact that it is so cryptic. Was it because she was hiding something, or was it more innocent in nature? I don't want to speculate too much, but as we just discussed, I wonder if she didn't tell anyone because she knew, like I would have told Mara not to go, that maybe her sister Kara would have said, hey, don't do this, especially alone cross country or, you know, whatever her plan was. Perhaps she didn't want to burden anyone with worrying about her and just ask for forgiveness after the trip.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if you're worried about judgment, and I think we've all been in situations where it's like, oh, family members are going to judge this decision, or I'm going on this trip or going here. And probably in my 20s, I made decisions like that where it was like last minute, hey, by the way, I'm going to Mexico or I'm going to Dominican. And I would tell them very last minute, not leading up to it. So it's like, oh, you're in school, you can't afford this type of thing. That conversation would be a moot point because it would already be paid for and it would already be scheduled.
Now, Leah had a particular fascination with Beat Generation novelist Jack Kerouac, who found fame during the 1950s after the publication of his autobiographical novel, On the Road, a fictionalized story which was based on the personal travels of himself and his friends across the United States. In fact, a woman whom Leah had hung out with at the coffee house would claim that Leah had discussed The Dharma Bums, Kerouac's follow-up novel to On the Road. Once again, the book is a fictionalized story based on events from Kerouac's life, including the time he spent working as a U.S. Forest Service fire lookout at Desolation Peak, which was located in the North Cascade Mountains of Washington, just south of the Canada-United States border. Leah was fascinated by the novel's theme of leaving behind the materialism of modern life and had expressed a desire to visit Desolation Peak.
I'm a big fan of Kerouac, and I actually think all young people should read On the Road at least, and I can see why Leah was moved by him. He's known for his mad quote, but my favorite is a little more obscure, where he describes his cross-country journey as being east of my youth and west of my future. This pretty much sums up what Leah was doing, spontaneous exploration.
Oh, I've never even heard that quote before. I'm one of those few people that hasn't read Jack Kerouac, so I guess I should go and read it now because I really love that quote.
I'm not an expert either, unfortunately, at Jack Kerouac, so there's not much I can say about him. I think a lot of my knowledge of him just comes from studying this case, but I have always wondered if Leah was kind of hoping to follow in his path and go on these like travels across the country and get all these life experiences and possibly write about it and publish a book at some point, because I know that she was very passionate about writing during that time period.
Did either of you either read the book, I think it's a book as well as a movie, Into the Wild, based on Christopher McCandless?
Yes, I haven't read the book, but I did see the movie that came out several years ago. And I can see parallels between that case and this one.
Yeah, I can as well. That was a really heartbreaking movie watching. I mean, it was heartwarming watching his journey to a certain point. But then when you watch this inevitable end, I was really gutted. And I guess they had to remove that van where his remains were found that were kind of in the wilderness because people were, I guess, getting hurt or maybe even dying trying to get there to visit the spot where Christopher had died.
Yeah, I haven't read or watched that, but Jules, I'm telling you, you have to read On the Road. It's so quotable. Like when I read it, I had to have a notepad beside me because I'm like, oh my God, that is such a good quote. My other favorite is where he's talking to somebody that he meets across country and the guy says, are you going to get to or are you just going? So there's so many good quotes in there. It's a great book.
All right, that's my homework before the next time we talk, is to read Jack Kerouac On the Road. Well, since Leah had previously granted Kara power of attorney over her bank accounts, she was able to look up Leah's financial transactions and able to track her movements since she left Raleigh on March 9th. Well, sure enough, she discovered that Leah had withdrawn $3,000 that same afternoon, and then she'd used her debit card to pay for a motel room near Memphis, Tennessee later that night.
The fact Kara had access to her bank account so quickly is key here. It would have taken a lot longer to subpoena these records from the bank, and then who knows if the investigators would ever have shared that information with the family. Leah's transactions serve as a roadmap for where she was headed, almost like GPS today. This is definitely something that I wish Mara had left behind, sort of a trail as to where she was headed. She left UMass and then there was nothing. There's no video or receipts. And the next thing we know, her car is in New Hampshire.
Really stuck with me when you told me the story about the first time that you watched the footage of Mara taking out money from the ATM and how you had to have watched that footage in front of video cameras. I think it was for the Disappearance of Mara Murray documentary. Is that correct?
Right. The first time I ever saw that footage was on the Oxygen Channel, cameras, lights, microphoned up. And it was really hard for me to see it because I think I told you, Jules, that I wanted to see that in private, you know, and just look at it. And because that's a last known footage of Mara. And I had to share that with everyone.
And we're pretty much going to have the same thing in this case, because they're going to uncover footage eventually of Leah at a gas station, which would turn out to be the last confirmed footage of her before she disappeared.
It's interesting, too, because people who are presenting this footage likely don't look at it in the same way that a family member would, right? They don't think like, oh, this could be really intimate for somebody to watch this. You're wanting to be alone with it and watch your sister, look at every line of her face, look at any little hint of emotion. For you, it's like this incredibly important emotional piece, whereas they're looking at it as this piece to solve the puzzle. So I can only imagine how difficult it would be with all these lights on your face. And then I remember you saying something like, I was trying to find something to say. And so I just like diverted attention away and said something about her jacket or whatever. And I thought that was just so sad, you know, because you were in this position where these heightened emotions, and yet you're having to share it with all these people you don't know.
Right. And I did do that. I said something stupid about the jacket, but that was just to probably keep myself from crying. But, you know, investigators didn't know Mara. So I would have been able to pick up on and key in on her mannerisms and things that she was doing and her facial expressions. You're exactly right. So I think the same is probably true with Leah, although I'm not sure how soon after they obtained the footage at the gas station that Kara and her brother were able to see that. It took me 13, 14 years before I ever saw that ATM footage.
I didn't know it was that long. I guess I could have done the math in my head, but that's an incredible amount of time, because what a precious piece. For them, they're looking at it as a piece of evidence, but what a precious memory almost for you, right? Any little last trace of Mara or any little last trace of Leah for her family would be seen as so, so precious.
So by following Leah's subsequent debit transactions, Kara was able to determine that Leah spent the next few days traveling west on Interstate 40 until she reached California and started traveling north on Interstate 5. The last recorded transaction was when Leah purchased gas in Brooks, Oregon at 12:57 a.m. on March the 13th. Since Leah appeared to be heading in the direction of Washington State, it seems plausible that she was planning to visit Desolation Peak, but it wasn't long before a shocking discovery would be made.
On March 18th, a couple was jogging on a remote logging road called Canyon Creek Road. That was located next to Mount Baker National Forest in Whatcom County, Washington. The road was adjacent to Mount Baker Highway, and the couple noticed some articles of clothing near the highway, including a shirt that was hanging from a tree branch next to an embankment. This embankment was near a slight curve at the top of an uphill slope of Mount Baker Highway, and when the couple took a closer look, they noticed a wrecked Jeep Cherokee at the bottom. Sure enough, when the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office arrived at the scene, they noticed that the Jeep had North Carolina license plates, and they were soon traced back to Leah Roberts. However, there was no sign of Leah anywhere. And even though virtually all of her personal possessions, such as her guitar, her compact discs, her clothing, her passport, and her driver's license and checkbook were inside or had been scattered around the Jeep, Leah's whole life was packed up in her Jeep. So this had to be pretty alarming for the officers who responded to this call.
Yeah, what I find most significant in the discovery of the abandoned Jeep are the items she left behind, particularly the passport, license, and checkbook, and jewelry. In contrast, in my sister's case, what I find significant is what we know she took with her cell phones, her keys, some alcohol, her purse. I would be very interested to learn whether Leah's keys were ever discovered. Do either of you know?
I don't think it's ever been stated anywhere. It's never been specified in any of the sources if the keys were actually at the scene. So I don't know if that might be a key piece of information they're choosing to withhold from the public or if they just weren't there.
I guess if it was like staged to roll down the embankment, you wouldn't need to have the keys in the ignition because the vehicle would just roll, right? So theoretically, Leah could have taken the keys, or if somebody else staged the scene, they could have taken the keys. So you're right, Julie, that's a really interesting detail I wish we knew the answer to.
And while some cat food and a cat carrier were inside the vehicle, Leah's pet kitten Bee was also missing. A more thorough search of the Jeep would also uncover a pair of pants containing over $2,400 in cash, and an engagement ring which had belonged to Leah's late mother was found underneath a floor mat. This would cause great concern for the Roberts family, since the ring was one of Leah's most treasured possessions and she almost never took it off.
I wonder if the ring underneath the floor mat was a signal. I've often wondered if the rag in my sister's tailpipe was a signal, given the framework in which she would have known to use it to stop the car from smoking when she's in a bind. Not a smart technique, of course, but I wanted to hear your thoughts.
I've actually never heard that theory before, but I find that very interesting, this idea that she decided to take it off and put it there if she was in trouble, maybe as a sign that if something had happened to her and they found the Jeep later on with the ring underneath, then maybe they would know that something was wrong. I know another theory is possible, that if she was sleeping on the road at some point, like I don't know if at some point she decided to pull over and sleep inside her Jeep, that she could have taken it off and put it under the floor mat just so nothing would happen to it, or in case somebody came along and tried to steal it from her and she decided to keep it hidden. But I know that her family says that's the most unusual aspect of the scene, because under very rare circumstances would she ever take it off. So that kind of made them figure that something must have happened.
It's also interesting that she had $2,400 in her pants. Like, usually if you got that type of money, you'd put it in a bag or you'd secure it in something. You wouldn't put it in the pocket of a pair of jeans, but it's a pretty good place to hide money. So I don't know, you might be right, Robin, in that if she was trying to avoid being robbed, or even if she did get robbed and somebody checked her bag, checked her glove compartment, checked all of these things, her most valuable possession, aka her mother's engagement ring, and the money might not be discovered. So that's super interesting. But I've often thought that what you said, Julie, about Maura's case, that there might be something to that rag in the tailpipe. Maybe Maura was communicating something. So it's possible that if somebody had done something to Leah and she got the opportunity to leave this almost breadcrumb trail, in the sense that she left these really crucial items behind. And it's one thing to leave money, but a whole other thing. I mean, even if people are going to ascribe to that theory that Leah walked off on her own, I've got a hard time believing that she would walk off on her own without that ring. I could believe every single other piece she could leave behind, but not that ring. At the time the Jeep was discovered, some of its broken windows were covered by blankets and pillows, presumably because someone had used the vehicle as a shelter, as Robin had just mentioned. The condition of the Jeep seemed to indicate that it had been traveling between 30 and 40 miles per hour when it went over the embankment. And since the contents of the vehicle had been tossed around inside, it likely rolled over at least once before it landed upright. But this is really odd. There'd been no sign of blood or other physical evidence inside or around the Jeep to indicate that someone had been seriously injured. And I don't know if this is a good sign or a bad sign. I mean, blood's never a good sign. But then it opens up the question, if Leah wasn't injured, why or who separated her from her Jeep and her possessions?
Again, eerily similar to my sister's case, where her car was found without any signs of serious injury other than the cracked windshield and the deployment of the airbags, but there was no blood. Some online sleuths postulate that Maura's abandoned car was a setup. I think Leah's car has a much stronger case for being a setup, given it was run off into the ravine.
Since there were no shatter marks on the glass or stretching of the seatbelt, it almost appeared like there were no occupants inside the vehicle when it crashed, though there was nothing to indicate that it had been rigged to go down the embankment on its own. Even if Leah had survived and was picked up by a passing motorist, there were no records of anyone matching her description having checked into any of the local hospitals. Since the Jeep was discovered on national forest land, the FBI would assist the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office with the investigation, and an extensive search was performed of the forest and the surrounding area with tracking dogs.
The FBI assist is key here because they have the resources. I know from experience that having all the resources available, especially during those early crucial stages of a search, are what solves these type of cases.
So how is this different from the early response and early search for Maura?
Well, essentially, there was no early search for Maura. Maura went missing on a Monday, and my family wasn't even notified until the next Tuesday evening. So when my dad showed up Wednesday morning, because he had to drive up from Connecticut, nobody was searching. He was the search.
So like within that amount of time, crucial details or evidence can be lost, right? And it's a dense forest. Robin, what do you think with regards to the type of search and the response here? Do you think that they did everything possible? Like, did local law enforcement engage the FBI? Is that how that worked? Or did the FBI suggest that they come and help with the search?
The impression I got is that the local law enforcement engaged the FBI, and that because I think they immediately realized this is national forest land, and now we have reason to bring them in, and any help we can get, we'll take. And I think there was like no expense spared. Like, they did a pretty thorough search of the wooded area and the surrounding community, and they couldn't find anything to indicate what happened to Leah. So it wasn't for a lack of trying that they were unable to find her.
Ah, that's what I forgot. Whenever it's on national forest land, the FBI can be engaged because it's federal land.
Exactly. Yes. That's why they became involved in this particular case.
So in the search for Leah, metal detectors were also used in case they picked up the metal rod, which had been inserted in Leah's leg following her previous accident 2 years earlier. However, no trace of Leah could be found anywhere. So her siblings, Heath and Kara, traveled to Whatcom County in order to assist with the search effort and circulate missing persons flyers.
I feel for Heath and Kara here because I know how that feels. It's an empty panic feel. It's awful. Like when you have nervous sweats and knots in your stomach, but they last all day and most of the night.
Yeah, I just cannot imagine how they felt because they had lost both their parents in recent years. And now their sister suddenly gets into an accident and goes missing. Like, just they must have been thinking to themselves, what next? Like, what more could possibly happen in our lives? It's just like the worst nightmare imaginable.
I'm sure you can relate, Julie, in that, you know, after losing Maura, you then lost your mother and you were dealing with, you know, other issues within your family. I'm sure that the trauma compounded on top of trauma.
Right. And the worst trauma of all is the unknowing. So the ambiguous situation that both, you know, my family and Leah's family feel and have felt for all these years. It's I wish it on nobody.
It's one of the most impactful things I think anybody's ever said to me. And it was the way that you described your situation and your open-ended trauma. Like, it really, really stuck with me. And I use it as an example often, because anytime I think of these cases where they're either unsolved murders or disappearances, it's that lack of resolution. And you described it in such a poignant and heartbreaking way that you're just going round and round because there is no resolution when it's open-ended. So both Heath and Kara are dealing with that too, while dealing with the grief of losing both parents. So I can't even imagine what this family was dealing with then and now, because as you well know, Julie, like, you're still dealing with this as time passes. It's like the wound doesn't close. Time doesn't heal that in which there is no resolution.
Right. Yeah. It kind of feels like you're frozen. And Maura is like frozen as this 21-year-old, the last that I've seen her. And it's hard to handle and deal and work through your trauma if it's just frozen and unresolved. And it's the worst type of feeling. And, you know, not many people can relate to that feeling, but Heath and Kara certainly can.
Investigators eventually uncovered some security camera footage from the gas station in Brooks, Oregon, where Leah had stopped to purchase fuel shortly before 1 a.m. on March the 13th. The footage showed Leah completing her purchase inside the convenience store alone, and everything seemed to be normal with her, though she appeared to turn her head several times to glance outside into the parking lot. Since the gas station did not have any exterior cameras, it was impossible to determine if Leah might have been staring at something. If Leah kept traveling north on Interstate 5, she eventually would have wound up in Bellingham, Washington, 300 miles away, where she could have turned east onto Mount Baker Highway. The embankment was located about 40 miles outside of Bellingham, and since Desolation Peak was located further east in that direction, it seemed even more likely that this was Leah's intended destination before she crashed.
It would soon be confirmed that Leah did stop in Bellingham, as a search of the Jeep uncovered a ticket stub for a screening of the movie American Beauty, which took place at the cinema at the Bellisphere Mall at 2:10 p.m. on March 13th. This compelled Heath and Kara to start circulating Leah's missing persons flyers around the mall, and she would be eventually recognized by employees from the mall's only sit-down restaurant, who said that Leah stopped in for a meal on the same afternoon that she saw the movie. So they claimed that Leah entered the restaurant alone and sat down at the bar before two men showed up separately and sat down on each side of her, and Leah could be seen engaging them in conversation.
This was a time before everyone had a cell phone, so to discover the security footage was extremely helpful in scoping the initial search down, I suppose. From my experience, I've learned that once people are exposed to a missing person flyer or they see somebody on the news, they tend to see that person everywhere. So it leads to a lot of false alarms. Thankfully, this wasn't the case here, and the employees actually saw and remembered Leah.
Robin, we talk about eyewitness identification all the time.
Yes, we do. It's very common in missing persons cases where eyewitnesses will think they've seen the missing person after having seen them on TV or a missing persons flyer, and then it turns out that their sighting was mistaken and that they actually saw someone else. But in this particular case, it sounds credible because, as I'm going to talk about momentarily, one of the witnesses who claimed that he interacted with Leah said that she specifically mentioned Jack Kerouac. And I don't think that was a detail that had been released publicly at that point. So if it wasn't Leah that she spoke to, then it seems like quite a coincidence that this other woman would mention Leah's favorite writer. So once Leah's disappearance started generating publicity, investigators would be contacted by a man who recognized her photo and confirmed that he was one of the men who sat down next to her. Like I just mentioned, he said Leah specifically told him about her love for Jack Kerouac and her travel plans, which seemed to confirm it was actually her. Police eventually tracked down the second man who spoke with Leah, and he corroborated the story, but he added an additional detail. He claimed that Leah left the restaurant with a third man whom she referred to as Barry, and this witness provided such a detailed description of Barry that investigators were able to put together a composite sketch for him. However, the first man contradicted this story and claimed that Leah left alone and there were no other witnesses from the restaurant who could corroborate having seen the mysterious Barry.
Leah's mention of Jack Kerouac was what sealed this for me. Like you said, who else would have known that detail? It would be like if Mara spoke to someone about running. I don't know what to make about this Barry person. No one else seems to recall him. It's a very specific name and description that was given. I think this is the beginning of some really strange turns in Leah's case.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me about the Barry thing is that Leah would be referring to someone by name, because as far as I can tell, she had never been to this location before. She had never been to Bellingham. So how would she recognize someone and know them by name in this restaurant unless she had met this Barry guy earlier in the day, like at the movie theater or something? It just seems really weird that she would be going off with this strange man whom she knew his name.
And nobody else remembers this Barry guy. And this gentleman seems to have a very specific recollection of this guy, like what he was wearing, what his face looked like, so much so that they could do a composite sketch. But yet not one other person even remembers him existing or being at this restaurant. And this other guy is either just really observant or this seems to be fabricated. There would be an additional strange lead when the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office received a phone call from an anonymous male. This was 1 week after the discovery of Leah's Jeep. The man claimed that his wife had seen a disoriented looking woman whom he believed was Leah Roberts at a Texaco gas station in the city of Everett. And this is located about 60 miles south of Bellingham. However, before the police could ask him for any further details, the caller seemed to panic before he abruptly hung up. This led to speculation that Leah could have become disoriented and lost her memory following the accident before she somehow hitched a ride out of the area and found her way to Everett.
I've experienced similar sightings of Mara, specifically being in the back of a car mouthing the words, "Help me." And this was also at a gas station up in New Hampshire shortly after she went missing. So I wonder why the person panics. My gut feeling is that it was just another false alarm, unfortunately.
I know there has been a theory pushed forward that it could have been someone who was involved in her disappearance, giving off a false tip to lead the police down the wrong trail. I do think it was a false alarm because I don't know how Leo could have gotten from the spot where her Jeep crashed all the way to Everett, which was located such a long distance away. But because this man never came forward, the police just have no idea if this tip was legitimate or not.
Robin and I just did the Springfield 3 for The Path Went Chilly. And this reminds me of the van sighting in that story. And like this woman says that she saw this van where one of the missing women was driving. And what was it that she said she heard of the conversation, Robin?
Yeah, she saw like a young woman matching the description of one of the missing females driving who looked nervous. And then she claimed that she could overhear a male in the back saying, "Don't do anything stupid." And then she kind of turned around, changed direction and went off. And it was a couple days later when she saw a missing persons flyer and thought, "This is the woman I saw in the van." And this whole incident became a lot more ominous for her. And she was convinced that she had seen Susie.
And you really got to wonder, right? Like, I'm sure that there was no malicious intent, but you've got to wonder about the veracity of this memory, because if you did indeed hear that, how close to a van would you have to be with rolled down windows to hear that sort of a statement? And if that was what you heard, wouldn't that be unsettling enough at that time that you would call the police? So I think people attach more significance and maybe jumble up memories a little bit with regards to missing people. Because I think you said earlier, Julie, it's like they're seen everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's been hundreds of sightings of Mara all over the world, everywhere. She's everywhere all at once and everyone's seeing her. But I do want to go back to this idea that maybe she hit her head. I mean, people have speculated that maybe Mara hit her head and, you know, didn't know who she was, didn't know where she was. And that could contribute or be a reason why Leah may have taken off that ring that she never would have taken off, because, you know, she didn't even know the significance of it. So just something to think about.
Yeah, that's a really good point. If Leah did, you know, injure herself, and if she lost her memory somehow and had maybe a concussion or some kind of amnesia, she might not have been acting in a characteristic manner. And it also makes somebody more vulnerable. If you can't even say what your name is or who you are or where you're going, makes you incredibly vulnerable to any type of person who would try to take advantage.
Right. I guess the counter argument to that is there were no signs of injury. So unless she was injured somewhere else, it doesn't seem that she was injured in the Jeep. So I don't know.
I guess if you hit your head, though, you could get like a head injury that would be a closed injury that wouldn't bleed, that could cause significant damage. So, I mean, it's possible that she could have hit her head maybe on the steering wheel and it didn't slice open her head, but it was enough to cause a serious concussion or result in amnesia. I mean, I'm not obviously a medical doctor. I can't say what type of injuries you could get going at that speed. I'm sure you could kind of plug in the variables. But yeah, it's interesting that it seems so staged that all these things are left and there is no sign of blood.
So Leah's story would capture the attention of Unsolved Mysteries, who produced a segment about the case which aired in August of 2001, but it did not lead to any further developments. Caro eventually made contact with a missing persons advocate named Monica Kaysen, the director of a nonprofit organization in Wilmington, North Carolina, called the Community United Effort for Missing Persons, aka the Q Center. On the four-year anniversary of Leah's disappearance, the Q Center would organize a caravan to travel across the country on Leah's exact route from Raleigh to Whitcomb County in order to spread awareness of her story.
I absolutely love this. There's so many kind and empathetic people that have reached out to help my family, just as Monica did here. It's so heartwarming, and it truly gives families hope. The spreading awareness is the absolute best thing you can do for a missing person cases, and cold cases for that matter. What a fantastic act of kindness.
Yeah, from what I've read of Monica Kaysen, she seems like an incredibly generous woman. I think she's still running the Q Center to this day and is always helping families of missing persons.
I mean, I think it's incredible because back then there was no Twitter and TikTok and Instagram. So Monica is literally driving across the country, acting like the social media we have today, but doing the real thing, like putting up flyers. I think it's incredible what she did.
And it's interesting. I was having this discussion with somebody maybe yesterday, and it applies to Leah's case as well as Maura's, that before we started recording, we were talking about Gabby Petito's case and how within minutes, basically, this caught on like wildfire. It became viral. It almost became like Maura's case, but for a better tech generation, and that it just blew up. And when you go back to, you know, the early 2000s, the late 90s, you didn't have social media in the same way. Like, yeah, in the early 2000s, Facebook existed, but only for university students. It only became widely used later. And I don't think Twitter was even around then. You didn't have social media. So I remember hearing about these cases for the very first time on the show Disappeared. It wasn't like they were blast across your internet screens and you were watching, yeah, like you said, Julie, TikTok videos on it. You didn't get this immediate awareness of missing people in the same way that you do today. So people like Monica Kazin were an integral part of being able to spread the word about cases like Leah's.
And I think you can say this about a lot of missing persons case, but I first heard of Maura's case by reading the write-up on the Charlie Project. I think this was the late 2009, 2010, before it was even on Disappeared. So that's why I think it's such a valuable website where you can learn about a whole bunch of missing persons cases that you otherwise might not learn about at all.
In November 2005, both Kara and Monica Kazin made an appearance on Larry King Live to discuss Leah's disappearance, where Kara would state, quote, "Leah was a young woman who was lost. You know, by the time Leah was 22, she'd lost both of her parents, and here she is on the verge of graduating from college, and I think she just really felt lost and didn't have a lot of direction, and I feel like she took this trip as a soul-searching trip. I think she just needed to go and get away to clear her mind," end quote.
Yeah, this quote resonates with me, as I feel Maura was in a momentary state of being lost as well. I can't imagine how Leah must have felt dealing with all that trauma. And in fact, I think Leah handled her situation better than most, all considering.
I can't imagine like what it would be like in your 20s to lose your both of your parents. It's just something you prepare yourself when you're in maybe your 50s or 60s. That it would be a time where you would lose your parents. But I don't think we ever prepare ourselves. Even at that age, I think it's incredibly impactful and difficult. But in your 20s, you're looking for that sense of direction and you're looking for somebody to help you with all of those major life choices. So we see Leah basically abandon what had been her current trajectory or plan, and that was finishing up her university degree only months before completion. So it does seem like she's maybe a little bit lost in exploring this alternate path and trying to get in touch with herself again, because she's lost this incredibly integral part of herself, both of her parents. And my heart just breaks for Keith and Kara as well, because I just can't imagine what that feels like.
And another thing that's worth mentioning is that Leah's severe car accident took place in between the loss of both parents, because her mother had died a few years later. She got into that terrible accident. And she finally made a full recovery and was planning to leave on a trip to Costa Rica for a field program. But then 3 weeks before this trip happened, that's when her father passed away. So it was just so much to take in during a short amount of time. So 1 year later, the original detective on Leah's case retired, and it would be reassigned to two other detectives who decided to take a fresh look at everything. At this point, the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office still had Leah's Jeep in storage, and after looking through the original paperwork, the two detectives realized that no one had ever looked under the Jeep's hood, so they decided to do so themselves. They would discover that the vehicle's starter motor had been tampered with, and a wire to the starter relay was cut. This meant that if someone wanted to intentionally crash the Jeep down the embankment while it was unoccupied, they could have turned the key and accelerated the vehicle without stepping on the gas pedal.
Shoddy police work. I mean, we all want to trust the police, and as a family member, you know, you're banking on the fact that the police are trained and they know what they're doing and they're going to be thorough. But sometimes they're just not. And sometimes they're under-resourced and they don't have, you know, the manpower to do it. Not that I'm saying that that's an excuse in this situation. But to be honest, if this was discovered early on, it would have most likely changed the entire trajectory of the investigation. You know, I've experienced many instances of lack of attention to detail and follow-up in my sister's case, but this is just blatant negligence. I feel for her family, and I would be angry.
And you and I have spoken about this before, Julie, but you'd said, you know, early on, it was sort of like, okay, the police are going to do their job. I'm going to trust them. And then you'd referenced a conversation you had with Sarah Turney, and you were like, yeah, this really inspired me to like kind of put the pedal to the metal and, you know, hold them to the fire, because they have a lot to account for here. And so being that family member and being that voice, and you were kind of reinvigorated. And I really like that, because we can't always trust that they're going to do everything perfectly and they're going to do everything right. So I think they do need to be accountable for the way in which they handle investigations.
Yeah. Talking to Sarah fired me up. I tell you, you know, the things that she has done, and, you know, acting like a boss and just walking right up in there in the police station, you know, in a respectful way, but questioning things. And it's okay to question things, because some things are missed. And this is a perfect example. And I think the fact that the police still had Leah's car in their possession is a testament to her sister, Kara, who was like, you know, keep the car in case you need it, in case you need to do further investigation. My dad actually did that exact same thing. Initially, they were going to release Mara's car back to us. And my dad was like, no, like, this is could be the crime scene. So eventually, he actually almost had to pay to have it stored in a local garage until the police came around and sort of repossessed it. So they've had it ever since. But good on Kara for making that decision.
Yeah, I remember being completely surprised when I heard this news about the starter, because I first became familiar with this case from Unsolved Mysteries. They aired this segment in 2001, which was years before they made this discovery. And the segment is kind of produced from the angle that this could have been an accident and that Leah just may have wandered away from the scene and could have been disoriented somewhere. But then you find out that the starter was tampered with, and that takes the case in an entirely different direction. And if they had known this information at the time they produced the Unsolved Mystery segment, then it probably would have looked at the case in an entirely different light.
Some fingerprints were also found on the underside of the hood, as well as traces of male DNA on an article of Leah's clothing. The detectives decided to place their focus back on the male witness who'd claimed he saw Leah leaving the restaurant at the Bellisphere Mall with a man named Barry. So it turned out that this man had a military background and worked as a mechanic, which could have given him the necessary knowledge to tamper with the Jeep starter. This man was living in Canada at this point, so investigators went to the trouble of obtaining his fingerprints and DNA.
I just wish it was done earlier, but at least it was done. You know, I've read it wasn't an easy process to obtain his fingerprints and DNA, given that he was in Canada, but at least they got him.
So in February of 2011, the investigation discovery true crime show Disappeared aired an episode about this story in which detectives claimed that this man's prints did not match the prints found on the hood, but they were still waiting for the results of the DNA testing. However, there has never been any public follow-up on what actually happened with the DNA, but we'll be discussing this issue in more detail on our next episode. At the time of this recording, 21 years have passed since Leah Roberts went missing, and there's still no conclusive answers about what happened to her. So I guess you could say the trail went cold.
So I think this is a good place to break for part one. So tune in next week to hear part two. Julie, do you want to let the listeners know where to reach out to you?
Yes, they can find me on my website, MauraMurrayMissing.org, or I'm on Twitter at JulieMurray2_9, or the Facebook group, Maura Murray Missing Official Group. It's a private group, but I accept most.
Robin, do you want to tell the listeners where to find you on social media?
Yes, I have a website for my podcast at trailwentcold.com. You can find me on Twitter, the handle Robin Warder. And I also have a Facebook group called The Trail Went Cold.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter. So please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.
Growing up as a latchkey kid in a small town in Maine, I always assumed I was safe. After all, unless it makes national news, murder isn't something people talk about around here. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Murder, She Told is a true crime podcast featuring crime stories, unsolved murders and missing persons, and baffling cold cases from my home state of Maine, New England, and small towns across America. These are the crime stories your hometown doesn't want to talk about, the mysteries buried deep in the newspaper archives of local American history. These are the homicides you've probably never heard of before. Through detailed storytelling and connections with family, friends, and investigators closest to the case, Murder, She Told will hit home for any true crime fan, whether you're from Maine or from away. Visit MurderSheTold.com to suggest your hometown crime story. And subscribe now wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kristen Seavey, and this is Murder, She Told.